From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson alongside Megan Mack. Hello.
Hello.
It's been a pretty good week. I think it's actually been a pretty good couple of weeks on the show.
Yeah, we've been very busy, but we've had great, great shows.
A lot of wonderful guests and sort of from far and wide. We've had people coming on the program sharing their perspectives on a number of issues. You know we love our show music, which is this. Yeah, that's Shadow Casting by the local band Rah Rah Riot. But we're going to play some more music now by a band called Muna. It's M-U-N-A, all caps. Song is called I Know a Place. And it's a song that Time Magazine has dubbed a new LGBTQ anthem for our country. A lot of people thought when they first heard it was written specifically about the impact of the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando last summer. But Muna was working on that song before that happened. It's about celebrating our humanity and refusing to bow to violence. It's a pretty addictive song, and it's a powerful message. Let's listen to a part of it.
Had the chance to talk to Muna's lead singer, Katie Gavin, during a discussion about efforts to promote and preserve equality for the LGBTQ community. She talked about the song and how she hopes people will receive it.
We started the song in 2015 during Pride Week at that time. And that was, if you'll remember, that was right after the Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage. So it was really, we started it in a celebratory place. But at the same time, I had a lot of friends that are in queer communities across America that were doing a lot of activist work and really bringing my attention to the issue that consistently remains urgent, which is the murder and harassment of trans women of color. And I see trans women of color as leading members of our community. If you look at, you know, Marsha P. Johnson, the Stonewall riots, it's like, I really feel that these are treasured individuals in our community who, in a very real sense, at all times need to be concerned for their safety and the safety of their physical bodies. So I wanted to try and speak specifically, if I could, to those members of our queer community. And that's why I brought in that imagery in the chorus about a place where, you know, everyone will lay down their weapons and everyone will be safe. And then, I mean, this has happened a few times for us in the process of writing as a band where we've spoken to something that then has manifested in the world in a way that we didn't expect. And that broke my heart, but then it also made me feel very happy that we had this already kind of to offer to our community. It definitely, I see why people think that it was a post-Orlando song, but it was not actually reactionary.
Now let's turn to our power grid. The New York Times wrote a wonderful story that explains how our lights are turned on, how much of our energy comes from carbon, how much from nuclear, and how much from renewables.
And New York State is trying to grow the share of renewables like solar. Right now, renewables account for about 25% of our energy. The state wants that number to be around 50% soon, maybe within a decade, maybe a little longer. But here's the problem. Local governments, counties, sometimes towns, are debating laws that would block or limit solar. Here's Suzanne Hunt of Hunt Global Green describing that dissonance.
It's been incredibly frustrating to watch the counties in upstate New York, many of them working against their citizens' best interests. And, you know, there are a number of concerns that folks have that are very legitimate. You know, there is a land rush for solar leases for huge industrial solar plants that concern people. And that's been mainly downstate where electricity prices are much higher. But folks are concerned, and that, you know, we definitely don't want to see hundreds and hundreds of acres, you know, just endless fields of solar panels. We want to do it in a thoughtful way. But seeing towns just knee-jerk and just moratorium, I think that the Urbana moratorium that they're thinking about is, I've heard that they're just thinking about it for large-scale systems. But even then, you know, so the town that I live in, the town of Jerusalem, just put a solar ordinance in place that limits the size of systems to 0.35. The largest system that can go in is 0.35. acres.
Which is how big, by the way? Can you give us some perspective?
Slightly. I'd have to think. It depends on if you need setbacks and all those things. But, you know, that's probably the roof space that we use at our place for our system at Hunt Country Vineyards, at my family's winery. But, you know, the size limit for a community shared solar array in New York, for example, is 2 megawatts. And that's going to take you 10 or 12 acres. And so if I want to, and I'm working with a number of communities across upstate New York that want to put in community-owned shared solar arrays so that you can get a much lower cost because it's much more efficient and your soft costs are much less. And then you can actually offer this low-cost power to especially low-income community members who probably can't, either don't own their home or don't have a strong credit score, so they can't get their own solar. And a lot of these townships that put in some of these limitations without considering community shared solar and without considering some of these other things. One other thing that I would say is New York State has a property tax exemption for solar and wind. And the whole idea is with that is that if you put solar on your home, you shouldn't get, you know, your property taxes jacked way up, because then your solar becomes uneconomic and it'll kill the market for solar. And we want people to become produce their own clean energy. Many, many, many of the counties are opting out of that. And it's been a real problem. People are calling me saying, I just had my tax assessment raised through the roof. No one puts a diesel generator in and gets their property taxes increased. But they put a solar generator in and they get punished. And that's got to stop. We have got to get our tax assessment figured out in these counties.
What's the reason they're doing that? What do they say the reason is?
They say, well, I can't speak for the counties, certainly, but I've heard that they're just cash strapped and they see what they think is a property improvement, even though it's a temporary, you know, it's not. Solar panels are then removed in 30 years or something, but they see a way to bring in short-term revenue, even though long-term it hurts the tax base, because the more citizens who are producing their own power and not paying money to a foreign-owned utility and keeping that money in the community, that actually strengthens the tax base over time.
And whether it's Urbana or Jerusalem, putting that limit again, 0.35 acre, for example, what did they say? Because that can impact real people and real businesses, could it not? So what did they say the reason is for that kind of a limit?
One of the concerns that some of the folks voiced was they're worried about huge solar arrays ruining the view from the lakes.
Eyesores.
And so my point was, no solar developer is going to pay top dollar for Lakeview property and pay, you know, much higher taxes. It just ruins the economics of the system.
Okay.
So then, and it's also not, by definition, you know, most of those sites are going to be on a hillside where it's not going to be optimal sun exposure. So a lot of these things, when people work through them, you know, they're understandable concerns, but when you work through them, they're actually not really a real problem.
Let's turn to a book about the decline of a small manufacturing town in southeastern Ohio. The book is called Glass House, and it's all about the collapse of jobs in Lancaster. For decades, Lancaster has been home to a company called Anker Hocking, which used to make many of the glass products that would show up in your house. Jars, tumblers, you probably had an Anker Hocking in your cupboard.
And in the 1980s, corporate raider Carl Icahn came in and shook up the company, and since then, most of the jobs, thousands of jobs, are gone. It's a story that you see in the Rust Belt, all across rural America. Heroin is a huge problem in Lancaster now. Author Brian Alexander is from Lancaster, and he spent several years writing the story of his dying hometown. Now, what he did not expect was that it would become a book that helped explain the rise of Donald Trump.
Despite the fact that Trump consults with Carl Icahn and others who helped destroy Lancaster's jobs, Lancaster residents voted overwhelmingly for Trump. In this clip, you'll hear Evan read a passage from the book and Brian's reaction about why people in rural America don't move somewhere else.
I found this remarkable when you cited Kevin Williamson in his commentary in National Review from March 2016. But frankly, I think this is how a lot of people feel when we think about the Rust Belt. We think about small towns where jobs have left. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read some of this and we'll talk about it.
Terrific.
This is Brian in his book quoting Kevin Williamson from National Review, which is a leading conservative journal. Quote, "The problem isn't that Americans cannot sustain families, but that they do not wish to. If you spend time in hardscrabble, white, upstate New York, or eastern Kentucky, or my own native West Texas, and you take an honest look at the welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children, with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, you will come to an awful realization. It wasn't Beijing. It wasn't even Washington, as bad as Washington can be. It wasn't immigrants from Mexico, excessive and problematic as our current immigration levels are. It wasn't any of that. Nothing happened to them. There wasn't some awful disaster. There wasn't a war or a famine or a plague or a foreign occupation. Even the economic changes of the past few decades do very little to explain the dysfunction and negligence and the incomprehensible malice of poor white America." He goes on to write, "The white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good. So does OxyContin. What they need isn't analgesics, literal or political. They need real opportunity, which means that they need real change, which means that they need a U-Haul." And he basically says, the factory is closed down because these communities deserve to die. End quote. I mean, Brian, that's remarkable. And I know a lot of people feel that way, but is he getting a chicken and egg thing wrong here? I mean, he's essentially saying they've got all these cultural problems. They deserve to die. This is just the way of the world. Whereas other writers have said, look, the drugs come to these communities when they lose hope. I mean, how do you view what he wrote there?
You know, I have obviously read it probably 50 times, and I wrote it and listened to it. Just hearing you read it again, I get really angry all over again. You know, it almost leaves me speechless. No, he's absolutely wrong, and he's wrong on a number of levels. He's wrong on a human level. He's wrong on a humane level, and he's wrong on a policy level. For probably 30, 35, 40 years, our political leaders of both parties have been extolling what they call real America and heartland America and small town values. All of that is really expressed in real life in a town like Lancaster, Ohio. And now here this guy comes along and says, none of that meant anything. Forget all that stuff. Get in a U-Haul and head to one of the coasts, or head to Houston or Chicago or someplace where you're going to be able to get a better job. To me, that's just an astounding betrayal.
And this is a conservative writer. I think in some ways since the election, progressives have often been lectured to understand rural America more, the white working class more, not to lecture them. This is a conservative writer lecturing them, you know, get the hell out of there, that your town deserves to die, that this is part of the evolution of corporate life, of the way businesses work here. I recall at some point in your book, and I don't remember who, Brian, so maybe if you can recall, you asked someone a question, you know, about the idea of moving. I think it was a woman, and she said, you know, like I'm from here, or I'm, I, you know, this is where I'm from, or, you know, is this idea that how could you say that I would leave? That this is
right.
My DNA.
You know, this. I mean, people forget about the social connections and family connections and the real sense of belonging to a place. And you're referring to a conversation I had with a woman named Rebecca Crutch. And we're sitting in a restaurant, and she's explaining to me, because she has advantages. She has a college degree. She's talented. She's attractive. She works two jobs, as many people do. She has a full-time job as a drug educator during the day, and at night she waits tables to try to support her family. And I said, look, you could go someplace else. Why don't you go? And she looked at me like I was insane, with these wide eyes, and she said, this is my town. This has meaning for me. And people forget that towns and places and geography and a sense of belonging to a web, that the fact that your great-grandfather came there and settled there, that matters to people.
Let's close with a little food. When you think agriculture, you probably think about the countryside, but we're focusing this time on urban agriculture. Rochester has more than 2,000 empty lots, and urban farmers envision crops growing across those spaces.
Nathaniel Mish manages the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm. He explained why Rochester is both progressive, but also blocking opportunity for urban farms.
Some cities have leasing models. Other cities make purchasing very easy. It's really great here that in Rochester it's free and it's very simple to get that permit. But again, it's built to treat urban agriculture community gardens as a temporary use on the land. The idea being that this is something that can be done on the land until quote unquote real development occurs there, which I think is unfortunate, and I think is a perception that we'd like to flip. Foodlink and the broader urban agriculture community, the urban agriculture working group that I work with. The Lexington Avenue Farm, which I manage, is actually the only, to my knowledge, the only urban agriculture site in Rochester where we have an actual lease with the city. So we're working on a multi-year lease. But
how come you got the lease when that's not really happening in other places?
Because we, a few years ago, built a hoop house on that site, and in the negotiations with the city and with zoning to get the permission to put up that hoop house, Foodlink stressed that we weren't going to make that investment in the land without some longer-term protections, that we weren't just going to get booted out if, you know, a dollar store came along.
All right, but just to clarify what Nathaniel's saying here, it sounds like what you're saying is the city of Rochester, in some sense, is really helpful with this because you can get the permits, mm-hmm. it's free, you can access the land, but it's viewed as temporary, and it's not necessarily viewed as a serious long-term thing.
Correct.
And are there other communities, models out there that you would like to see Rochester follow that do view it more seriously?
So I've been learning more about Cleveland. Well, I want to stress, too, that I do feel that the city of Rochester does take community gardening seriously in urban agriculture, and they've been a really great partner in a lot of different ways. We're trying to work with them and work with our gardeners in general to just kind of get to the next level. So in Cleveland, it's actually, they had a ton of vacant city-owned lots. You know, it's kind of the classic Rust Belt trajectory. And they decided that they were really going to focus on letting residents decide what was going to happen with those. So in Cleveland, it's very simple to get a lease on city-owned land that protects it for multiple years.
Well, that's another flawless edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Oh, Megan, Mac, and I always have so much fun doing this, don't we?
We do. There's a lot on the cutting room floor, so to speak, every week.
There actually, I know we've mentioned this before, but there are really good outtake reels that no one will ever hear. And that's a sad
thing for
the world.
They can never leave your computer and my computer.
That's a sad thing for the world, though.
It is.
It would make people happy. But you can only get regular Weekend Connections to podcast unless you come hack our computers. Don't do that. Maybe just listen to the show. It's noon to 2, Monday to Friday. WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll work on more outtakes for you someday.
Have the best weekend.